Joining me today is Omar Solomon, the co-founder of College Hunks Hauling Junk. Welcome, sir.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
I'm looking forward to digging into this. You and Nick are a real success story for Tampa Bay, both in your regional company and your latest company, Trash Butler. So I think we got a lot to dig into today.
Absolutely. We love Tampa Bay. It's been a big part of our success.
Let's start from the very beginning. When you grew up, your mom had a furniture store, and so that exposed you to small business. You know, how did you feel as far as the entrepreneurial world, or did you understand being an entrepreneur way back when, and what did it mean to you?
Yeah, no, surely didn't really know what an entrepreneur was back then. You know, there weren't shows like Shark Tank. You know, being an entrepreneur wasn't an option. So for me, I was certainly someone that was a, you know, quote unquote, I guess you could say, troublemaker, didn't really like school. And, you know, it's funny because Nick, my business partner, and I, we met in 10th grade in detention of all places. And so, you know, I think looking back, we both had trouble sitting still, probably like to push the boundaries of what was allowed. And, you know, those were kind of entrepreneurial qualities. But back then, you know, I think we were just written off as troubled youth, for lack of a better word. So didn't even realize what an entrepreneur was until that first summer that we started with the cargo van.
So you absorb somewhat of what it's like to be an entrepreneur from your mom, but at that point you really just saw it more as a business versus her, you know, or you actually tapping into how she was as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I mean, I think the exposure was, you know, as a small business owner, and I didn't probably put two and two together that a small business owner is the same as an entrepreneur. For us, it was, you know, at the dinner table talking about employees and what the challenges were. So very early on, I realized how difficult it is to run a small business. But even with that, it wasn't like the aha moment that, oh, you know what? There's this whole path in life, which is, you know, being your own boss and being an entrepreneur. And that didn't happen until that summer in 2003 with the cargo van.
And so at that point, you had met Nick in detention. You guys had become pretty close friends.
Yeah, we hit it off right away. We became best friends. You know, we like to say we were partners in crime before we were partners in business. And so became really good friends, went to university pretty much opposite sides of the country. So he went to school in California and I went to school down in Miami, but we would always link back up in Washington, D.C. for summer break. And so the summer before our senior year was when a business was launched with the cargo van. And, you know, the story behind that was, you know, got back home for summer break. Nick secured a very prestigious internship at the IMF. And I was really excited because I was going to do absolutely nothing. So my summer was going to consist of sitting at home, playing video games, you know, going to the pool. And my mom caught wind of that. And she said, absolutely not. You are going to get a job. The word of the day is job, J-O-B. And having done all the typical jobs that college students do, whether it's, you know, waiting tables, I worked at the mall, I knew I didn't want to do that. Nick was sort of filling me in on what intern life was like. And this was right when Office Space was, you know, the movie that kind of exemplified what an office environment was like. And I just dreaded the thought of sitting in a cubicle and making copies all day. So I asked my mom if I could borrow the van that she used for her furniture store, and essentially called my buddies up and told them, hey, I got this harebrained idea that, you know, we can make money hauling junk. All we need is a name. And, you know, after probably one or two beers, the name started to get more creative. And actually my mom looked at us and said, you know, you guys are like the College Hunks who haul junk. And we busted out laughing. And then we looked at each other and said it again. We're like, College Hunks hauling junk. And as we said that, you could literally feel like the earth move because it was such a good name, and put up some flyers around the neighborhood the next day. And 6 o'clock that evening, cell phone rang with the first client.
That's great. So what drove that call to their friends? Was it just not wanting another service job and also not wanting to go to the cubicle? And so there's sort of an entrepreneurial switch. Did you say, there's got to be a way for me to make my own money? What was sort of that light bulb that went on there?
Yeah, it was exactly that. It was, okay, I didn't want to do a job that, you know, I was going to have to clock in, clock out. I didn't want an internship. I was like, there's got to be another way to make some money and do something different. And so that was the catalyst. And then literally, like, as soon as we put the flyers out, the phone started ringing. So I was like, wow, there's a need for the service. People really love the name. And so we would, you know, wake up at 6 a.m. The van had no air conditioning. This was, you know, hot, humid summer in Washington, D.C. We'd work until 7, 8 o'clock at night. But it was the first time in, you know, my life that I found something that I was passionate about. And it's not that I was passionate necessarily about hauling junk, but that was that light bulb where it's like, wow, you know, this is what being an entrepreneur is, right? You know, you're your own boss, you make your own decisions. And that aha moment is still fuel for us today in that we now have thousands of team members across the country who are working in, you know, College Hunks trucks. And we want them to have that same kind of inspiration that we did because they very much are their own boss. They control the customer service, the marketing. You know, the College Hunks franchise owner isn't driving around with them. So when they set off in the morning in that truck, they are pretty much running the show. And we've had a ton of team members who have either moved on to take what they've learned and start their own business or go on to become Fortune 500 executives or move up, you know, within our company. It's very much a launch pad for entrepreneurship. You know, that experience that we had, that anti-work sucks experience is still very much alive with our team members today.
And so in that first summer, how did you run the business? How did you decide on your pricing? Were you just splitting everything equally or did you hire your friends on an hourly rate and then you had a spread on that?
Yeah, good question. So the very first job I remember we went to, I called, you know, two of my buddies. We show up. She said, how much is this going to cost? You know, she had a whole basement of stuff that she needed to hold away. And everyone looked at me and I was like, man, I haven't even thought that far ahead. In my mind, I'm thinking $50, but somehow I just said $250. And she said, great, no problem. And she handed me the $250. And I remember standing there looking at that, thinking to myself, this is the most amount of money I've ever made in my life. I got home. I felt like I was P. Diddy. I was making it rain. I'm like, I'm going to be a full-time trash man. I'm never going back to school. So, you know, we had no idea how to do anything. I had no idea how to price and sort of figure it out as we went along and started to say, okay, well, you know, let's charge based on how much space it fills up in the van. You know, let's give a price up front. You know, I would find, you know, if it was my buddies or someone else, I would, you know, pay them some sort of like percentage of the job. There was no system or plan. It was kind of ad hoc. You know, a lot of times I'd have to wrestle my friends out of bed because they were sleeping off a late night. So it was not certainly a well-run oiled machine, you know, so very much seat of our pants.
And Nick was still in his internship at this point?
Yeah, so Nick was at an internship. And so he would hear stories about, you know, what I was doing. And he actually would promote the business. The IMF had like a job board where you can promote businesses, ask questions. So he was promoting the business and kind of helping behind the scenes with getting clients from the World Bank and the IMF. And then he would hear these stories of, you know, what I would endure during my day. And I think it sort of got him excited about this whole concept of, you know, being an entrepreneur. And he really was living the opposite experience. So it sort of excited both of us.
So early on then, it was your show there. And so when you had your friends working, they were literally working for you. You were paying them an hourly rate or you were deciding what they got. It wasn't like we're all in this together. This was you, you know, handling the customer service, setting up the deals, and then just, you know, dragging them out of bed to actually do the work.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of that. And at times it would be hard to get my friends. So I'd have to hire, you know, someone that worked at my mom's store or some other person to come out and help. So yeah, I was kind of running the show, figuring it out and making a whole lot of mistakes along the way.
So the summer happens, you get to the end of the summer, you're making this good money, like you said. So what was sort of your mindset towards the end of the summer, knowing you had this year of school ahead of you? Did that plant the seed to say, I need to get back to this? This is going to be my future? Or were you just like, summer's over, it's time to go back to school?
Well, it's funny. So, you know, it planted the seed of this whole entrepreneur thing, right? And as I'm selecting classes for senior year, there was a class called entrepreneurship. So I'm like, well, perfect. Let me enroll in this class. And the first day of class, the professor makes an announcement that there's a business plan competition and they were going to open it up to the entire university and give out $36,000 in prize money. First place was $10,000. And if you made it to the top 25, you would get $500. And I just heard $500 and I perked up because again, that was, you know, more money than I'd really ever seen. So, you know, I'm like, well, I could maybe get 500 if I place in the top 25. I told some of my buddies at college, I'm like, hey, I'm thinking about entering this business plan for a company called College Hunks Hauling Junk. And they told me, man, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard. you're never gonna get anything for that. So I was feeling down. I was like, oh, maybe I'm over betting on this concept, and actually ended up calling Nick again. And Nick was really bullish. You know, he was always pushing me on this concept. And he said, man, you could win the whole thing. Definitely do it. So wrote a business plan, sort of pulled a note all nighter. Actually, it was going out to meet Nick and some buddies for spring break, and handed it in as I'm going to the airport, and got a call that it made it to the finals. So presented to a panel of judges, very much like a Shark Tank, mini Shark Tank experience, and presented, walked out of the room, and one of the judges chased me down and said, hey, you know, that's a really awesome concept. If you need anything, let me know. Here's my business card. He walks back in the room and they scored you on a number of different things on a scale of 1 to 10. And one of them was feasibility in real life. And he'd scored me a 6 out of 10. And he scratches his head. He's like, I just chased this kid out of the room. You know, seems like I shortchanged him on the score. So he changes it from a 6 to a 9. And the business plan ended up winning first place by 1 point. So I got a giant oversized $10,000 check. You know, Happy Gilmore was a popular movie back then. Some people say I kind of look like Adam Sandler. So
yeah, got your Happy Gilmore check.
I got a Happy Gilmore check in the car. And that was a huge, I mean, another, you know, big lucky break for us. You know, if my mom didn't have the van, this business wouldn't exist. If that judge didn't change the score, you know, I don't think we would have started the business. So two huge turning points for us.
So, you know, that judge aside, you know, that sort of the technical scoring aside, if I would have walked up to you 2 hours after you found out you won and asked you why you won that competition, what do you think your answer would have been?
You know, it was, I think, a combination of the fact that I'd done it the summer before. So a lot of folks that were presenting were just ideas and concepts, but it was like, well, hey, I've done this. I made, you know, $14,000 this summer. Nobody else, I think, had a business that was actually, you know, tested. So I think it was a combination of having done it, having that real world experience. I think the vision for where it could go, even in the business plan, it's funny, we just happened to read it just a couple months ago from that competition. And there were things in that business plan that are actually still true today, you know, expanding via franchising, really big on company culture, incentives through contests and the way we compensate our team members. Like a lot of that is still true. And then the name, I mean, you know, the name is such a catchy name. And I think that like immediately the judges just loved it. So it was a combination of all of those things.
You know, as this world of entrepreneurship opened up to you, did you think about other ideas, or was it just, you know, this works, I'm going to ride this train? And it was always about College Hunks from day one.
Well, I mean, I'm sure, you know, as you talk to lots of entrepreneurs and you know yourself, like we all have that ADD and we're always chasing shiny objects. So this certainly hasn't been the only thing that we've pursued. And sometimes it might be to our detriment because there's only so many bicycles that you can ride. But it's been a really nice platform to build other concepts, you know, Trash Butler being one of them that was spawned from, you know, College Hunks. So Trash Butler is a B2B service that's for apartment communities. And we sign contracts. We provide what we call doorstep valet trash pickup for the residents. You know, that was born out of kind of College Hunks and some of the other things that we've done, you know, in branching off to do moving and potentially now to do storage. A lot of that has started with our core business, which is the College Hunks business. But yeah, always serial entrepreneur, always looking for new things to launch and invest in, and sometimes to our own detriment, I think.
You win the contest. What happens after that then? You've got this head of steam going to sort of catapult you forward. How does your senior year look then?
Well, win the contest, you know, it was on top of the world. You know, you handed 21, I guess I was 21, 22 at the time, you know, in Miami, you got handed $10,000. You know, to me, that might as well have been $100,000. It was just like the best feeling, best moment for me. Probably spent 80% of it in like a month. You know, it was like $1,000 when I was heading back home. But you know, it's funny, even after doing it that summer, winning the business plan, Nick and I were still, I think, had this mindset that you got to get a job after college. And so we both ended up getting corporate jobs literally a block away from each other. So,
and that was just luck, or was there any planning in that?
No, just blind luck again, sort of. His job was called National Economic Research Association, and I worked for a company called Healthcare Advisory Board. So, you know, pretty much as they sound, pretty boring corporate office, you know, downtown DC.
People stealing staplers.
Yeah, people stealing staplers, meeting up for our lunch break and like, man, we got to do this for 40 more years. This is going to be tough about a month into it. So one day he emailed me, hey, what's your timeline to start the business? And I responded back in all capital letters, my timeline's right now. And pretty much that was it, you know, put in my notice and then started College Hunks. We bought a truck. We got a website, had no idea still how to run a business, had no idea how to do payroll or marketing or sales, and did it all. You know, the story we always tell is the 800 number at the time on the side of the truck was routed to our cell phone. So we'd be driving the truck and someone would complain about our driving and it would, you know, route to our cell phone. We'd be the one answering it and telling the person, oh, you know, I'm going to have a stern talk with that employee when he gets back. So we probably fired ourselves a couple of times. And we realized, man, if we want to truly grow this, scale this business, we can't be hauling the junk, answering the phone, doing customer service. And someone recommended a book called The E-Myth by Michael Gerber, which is like a popular book amongst small business owners. And that book was just like, you know, totally spoke to us. And sort of the core of the book is you got to work on the business, not in the business. And once we changed our mindset to, hey, we have to figure out how to work on the business, it really changed everything. And we were able to grow really rapidly.
Did you have any thought around taking on a partner, you know, understanding that, you know, sometimes when you're friends, good friends, and you go into business together, there's risks there. What was sort of your, you know, understanding or thoughtfulness around taking on a partner, and especially one that's a good friend?
Yeah, you know, it's such a great question. And honestly, a lot of it was luck in that my best friend happened to be the perfect partner. His strengths are complementary to sort of the things I'm not great at, and maybe vice versa as well. So again, we've had a lot of luck in our professional business, entrepreneurial lives. And probably one of the bigger lucky breaks was the fact that we met in 10th grade. And then, you know, the fact that we just happened to be perfect complements to each other. So I knew his personality. I certainly didn't know what he was going to be like as a business partner, but I knew he was like just a tenacious, hardworking, X's and O's kind of person. While I'm a little bit more on the creative, visionary side, he was going to get shit done. So I knew that, but obviously you don't know until you get into business with someone. And you know, we had a discussion. We're like, look, I think together we can kill this. Let's be 50-50. And it's been a perfect partnership. Doesn't mean that we don't fight or disagree. But from the very beginning, I think he and I have had the same vision for the company. Like he's always seen it, even that early day of when it was with the cargo van. He's like, this could be something big before many other people thought so. And, you know, having that vision of like, okay, we could build a really iconic brand, something that, you know, is known across the country, you know, seeing our orange and green trucks everywhere. And then the fact that our personalities are very similar, but then also different. And it's just like a perfect puzzle piece. So, you know, I hear from a lot of people that say, oh man, you know, 90% of partnerships don't work, right? It's just like, you know, you hear about marriages, half of marriages end in divorce. It's worse for business partnerships. And, you know, for us, you know, it's been over 15 years, you know, we've stayed best friends through it and stayed, I think, healthy partners. And a big part of that is we just are pretty open. Like if he does something that pisses me off, you know, I say it, and then vice versa. We kind of hold each other accountable. There's no kind of letting things bottle up or fester. You know, we'll have it out. And then once we get in the locker room or between the lines of the game, we put our helmets on and go fight.
With those, you know, potential disagreements, well, first I actually want to ask about decision-making. So did it sort of evolve that you each had your sort of realms within the company and sort of whoever had that realm, they had the final word? Or were you really able to keep everything, you know, decisions across the board truly, you know, collaborative and 50-50?
No, we realized early on we probably should have some division of duties. And it just happened that, again, our strengths played into what each one of us were working on. So, you know, for me, it was marketing. Nick was, you know, on the finance side. We both shared a little bit of the operational stuff. But, you know, it was really as the business evolved, you know, marketing and the call center fell under me. And then finance and franchise development, franchise sales fell under Nick. Today, we're at 150 franchises, and Nick and I both what we call kind of sit in the visionary slash owner's box. We subscribe to something called EOS, Entrepreneurial Operating System. It's a book called Traction by Gino Wickman, which is a great book for sort of medium-sized and large-sized organizations. And, you know, for that, you know, the concept is like every successful organization needs to have a visionary and an integrator. And our integrator is our COO, a gentleman named Roman Cohen. I mean, that's another great story. You know, you could spend a whole hour just hearing about his story, but that's what we do now. So Nick and I both sit in the owner's box as visionaries, and now we have a COO that runs the day-to-day. But in the early days, yeah, we had a division of labor. We kind of knew who owned what.
So going back to you quit your jobs and you started the business. How did that work? Did you immediately try to get some money? Were you bootstrapping it from day one? What was sort of the first year? What did that look like?
Yeah, it was totally bootstrapped. I mean, you know, we couldn't even get a truck loan. I think we went to 3 or 4 banks. They all said no. Finally, Bank of America gave us the loan. So credit to them because they helped start the business for us. And then, you know, a couple $1,000 for the website and it was just completely bootstrapped. And, you know, I would go on the trucks Monday through Friday. Nick would go on the weekends, or we'd switch off. You know, we would have this phone where the calls would come through, a Nextel phone, and then we'd write the jobs in a binder. And, you know, neither Nick or I have good handwriting. You know, that's one thing we share is terrible handwriting. So, you know, we'd have to struggle reading where the job was. We'd yell at each other because we couldn't read the phone number. So it was a totally bootstrapped business from day one.
And how were your stress levels with regard to cash flow and just, you know, tending a baby business?
Oh man, it was all over the place. High stress. You know, we'd yell at each other. You know, we'd fight about, you know, whose turn it was to unload the truck at 5 a.m. This was DC. You got to imagine like the traffic. We had no system for how the jobs would come in. So we would do a job in Maryland at 8 a.m. and then have a job in Virginia at 10 a.m. And, you know, for those of you that don't know DC, I mean, getting from Maryland to Virginia at rush hour is like a 2-hour thing. And then we'd go back to DC. So there was no rhyme or reason for how jobs were being scheduled. We'd be in the truck for just driving for hours, waking up at 5 a.m. to go unload the truck at a transfer station, which is basically like a glorified word for a dump site. And you can imagine what that smells like in the dead of summer in Washington, DC. So it was a trial by fire, man. It was quite a experience, to say the least.
So when you finished that first year, you know, you've been busting your ear, driving, you know, actually in the business. Was it just the money works? Or did you finish that first year and say, man, there were more expenses than we thought. We didn't make as much as we hoped, too many hours sitting, paying labor in the truck. And so what adjustments did you have to make after that first year?
We were lucky. I mean, this was 2005. So this was in the middle of the housing boom. DC is a great market for home service businesses. So there was cash flow coming in from day one. And so it was actually working. And now we were also expanding. So we went from, you know, 1 truck to 2 to 3 to 4. All of a sudden we had 8 trucks in less than a year and a half. The cash flow was there, but we had no true system. We had no like operational manual or, you know, system for how to manage the job calendar, no software, there was nothing. So things had to be built from essentially the ground up, right? But luckily, the one thing we did have was we did have the business and the leads and the jobs coming in. The other thing that was a really big pivotal moment for us was the Washington Post did a big article in the Metro section a couple months after we launched. And that was back when people actually read newspapers. And so they did a front page Metro section article, and it just went from like, you know, 2 jobs a day to 15 jobs a day overnight. And it was gangbusters from there. And it also opened our eyes to how big PR and marketing can be. So we were fortunate that there was cash coming in.
And you've had some noteworthy branding experiences. And so I'd love to hear, you know, obviously you went a little bit against the grain or a little bit outside the norm with just even the name of the company in the beginning. And so you sort of always had this, you know, irreverence where you could have fun with your brand and go that direction. You know, so at some point Shark Tank comes into play. You know, what was your sort of thought in how you were getting yourself out there creatively at that point? And I guess leading into how did Shark Tank come into play?
Yeah, I mean, the brand is certainly I like to say it was a viral brand before there was viral brands, because this was 05, 06. Facebook was just launching. People would take pictures of our truck and you know, they might post it on their Facebook, or they'll talk about it at the dinner table. And people don't do that with Stanley Steamer, right? It's one of the few brands where people really have an emotional reaction to. The trucks are bright orange and green. So from the very beginning, we had a kind of a very guerrilla marketing mindset, whether it was parking the truck in visible locations or putting up the yard signs. You know, we had this guerrilla, heavy, heavy guerrilla marketing mindset. In 2009, an employee basically walked into our office and said, "Hey, look in the back of this Inc. magazine. There's a small little blurb that they're casting entrepreneurs to pitch their business on a show." So again, this was, no one had heard of Shark Tank. This was season one Shark Tank before it even launched. So we said, "Oh, that sounds kind of cool. Well, let's send in a tape." So we contacted them and we read the kind of the language. And essentially it was, you know, "Hey, you can pitch this show, but the production company is going to get a percentage of your business regardless of if these people invest or not." So we're like, "Well, we don't want to pitch College Hunks. Let's come up with something that's similar." And so we came up with College Foxes Packing Boxes, which was kind of a sister company to College Hunks. We put a tape together, we sent it in, and they called back and said, "Oh, this is great. You guys can fly out to California and be on this show." And so the show was Shark Tank, and it was episode one's series premiere of this show that nobody had heard of. You know, I told my mom, "I'm going on Shark Tank." And she was like, "You're scuba diving? I didn't even know you did that." Because again, it was just unheard of. So did it, went out there. It was a awesome, crazy, wild experience. Kind of felt like a 12-round boxing fight. Nick and Kevin O'Leary got into it. He called us pigs. Nick told him to stop talking. Robert Herjavec made an offer to invest in both the College Hunks and the College Foxes business. We ended up turning it down, but it really made for great TV and it gave our brand national exposure. So it was an awesome experience.
Do you remember what percentage the production company was expecting?
It was vague. So it was like something like 1% or 3%. And Mark Cuban, when he got on the show, he fought to remove that language. So he was the reason why they stopped doing that. So it was a very vague contract, which sort of gave us pause about pitching College Hunks.
Sure, that made sense. And that's a nice pivot to use the Trojan horse or whatever.
College Foxes. Right. We actually thought it could be good, but we ended up deciding to pass on that business concept. But they all pretty much understood that it was maybe a little bit of a Trojan horse. So they all wanted College Hunks, and at least some of them wanted to invest, some of them passed. But Robert and Kevin O'Leary both made offers that we turned down.
And, you know, going into that, you got the bump from the Post. You know, you're already at 8 trucks. And then if you go from, you know, a couple jobs or, you know, to 15 jobs, at this point, were you thinking that you needed bigger capital to support the demand, you know, in advance of the expected cash flow? Were you actually looking to raise, or was that mostly a marketing exercise?
Well, yeah, we never took outside capital. So at that point, when we went on Shark Tank, we probably had 11 or 12 franchises. So from the very beginning, we had this idea that franchising was going to be the way to expand. You know, it gives you a nice way to expand without having to necessarily put a lot of capital. I think we were pretty naive because we just thought, "Oh, franchising, we're going to make tons of money. We're going to be like McDonald's." You know, little did we know it's not easy and it's a very expensive process to get to, you know, a cash flow positive sort of state. So we had about 10 franchises when we went on the show, and the show did, the Shark Tank bump, as they call it, was real. We did see a lot of interest in franchise opportunities and sort of just overall brand recognition, but we never took outside capital.
You talk a little bit about your philosophy with, you know, franchisees. What did you learn from those first 10 that helped you shape, you know, who you accept and who you want to partner with going forward?
I mean, the biggest thing is, you know, franchising, while you can provide them the systems and you can provide them the plan, you can't really give them effort or grit. Those are just things that I think people are either born with or sort of develop over time. And so in the early days, we didn't have an idea as to like what makes a franchisee successful. And partially it was our fault because it was still a new concept and we didn't have all of the X's and O's, you know, dotted. But back then, our franchise training was, you know, Nick and I sitting in the office saying, "Okay, you get one truck and then hopefully you get enough business and then you get a second truck and then, you know, go out there and kick butt. There was no real training. There was no real system. You know, we were in a tiny little office on Gandy Boulevard. So I'm still surprised people even bought franchises back then. But, you know, what we did realize and what we have realized is when you get past the branding, the system, you know, you can have all of that. You know, today we have technology, we have manuals, system, everything that you can imagine to become successful. But if you don't have that grit and that effort mentality, it's going to be hard to win. And the folks that have it, and the folks that don't, don't. So we've become extremely selective with who we award a franchise to. And we put them through the ringer. So it's not like anybody can just come in and throw us, you know, a check for $50,000 and get a franchise. They have to go through an interview process. They have to meet with the team. We put them through pretty difficult exercise before we award them the franchise.
So, you know, looking back, you took a shot at it in that first summer before your senior year and it worked. You did the quick business plan and it won. Certainly some really amazing, yeah, you can look back and you can always think there's some amazing pivotal moments. You know, that guy, the judge, you know, chasing you down and then giving you the extra points to let you win by one. The crazy one that, you know, Nick ends up a block away from you so you guys can build the steam up for this at lunch, which, you know, was probably the most fortunate one, I think. And, you know, all of that, it seems to have worked. And, you know, leading up, and of course, you put in a massive effort and busted your ass and went through all the things, you know, and then leads to the book, The Effortless Entrepreneur. Do you feel like people make business harder than it needs to be, that they make it too complex? And, you know, you seem to have just found the path through the woods and come out the other side of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the title Effortless Entrepreneur is not meant to say business or entrepreneurship effortless. It's, you know, it's really like when you watch Michael Jordan play, he makes it seem effortless, but you think about all the hours of practice and time he's put into that. And it's the same thing with business. There's it takes a Herculean effort, but it can get to a point after you put in, you know, maximum time, maximum effort to where you can sort of run sort of like the 4-hour work week philosophy or mentality. And we see it with our franchisees too. You know, we have franchisees that are working 10 hours a week and cash flowing a ton of money and buying their dream homes, but it didn't happen overnight, right? They put in the effort and the time to get it to that point. And it's the same thing for the sort of the mindset of the book was, you know, what were the things that we wish we had known when we were starting the business that we learned? So there's these 10 business commandments that we created and that we advocate. And one of them is, you know, we did borrow from the E-Myth, which is working on the business, not in it, but there's some other ones there as well. And so those 10 business commandments really allow someone to build their business quickly and get it to a point to where they're not pulling their hair out. Because a lot of folks will say business ownership is like lighting your hair on fire and trying to put it out with a hammer. And that's certainly true, but it doesn't have to always be like that. It's a roller coaster. There's no getting past that, but you can get it to a point to where it can exist without you putting in all the effort, where you can, you know, elevate and delegate to team members and you can have an asset that is making money without your day-to-day involvement.
And do you credit the E-Myth? Was that the sort of catalyst for that? And when you were, you know, when you were driving the trucks, sitting in traffic, at that point, were you aspiring to that or did that come a little later?
The E-Myth was the first aha moment, right? That was like, we read that and the book just spoke to us. It like leapt off the page and grabbed us and was like, wow, we're doing this all wrong. So that was the first one. But then we've read, you know, I mean, there's so many books along the way from, you know, the Jim Collins, Good to Great. Now, you know, fast forward, Traction is the book that I think has completely reshaped our business. It's a little bit more now advanced of a company and more advanced of an organization. So the Gino Wickman philosophy on how to run your business has been really, really straight for us today. And a lot of our franchisees are using that as well. So there's been just a lot of these books along the journey that have spoken to us and have shaped the way we execute.
And what's the thing that most jumped out at you about scaling that surprised you or that was the big struggle when you really, you know, turn into a large organization?
You know, I think the key is alignment and accountability and hyper-focus. And if your team's not aligned and if your team is not being held accountable and you don't have healthy conflict, because people think good culture means there's no conflict, but it's really the opposite. When you are at the point of having a really strong company culture, conflict is probably one of the biggest parts of it. And it doesn't mean, you know, fighting and second guessing each other, but it means, you know, really having a clear sort of sense of trust amongst your team members to where you can disagree. But then once you all agree on something, you have the alignment and focus to not second guess it. So once something's been decided, everybody's rowing in the same direction. So, you know, I think the key is hyper alignment, hyper execution, and then sort of a nice amount of grit mixed in there. And when you have those things and you've got the business model, you can really start to scale quickly.
Great. I want to talk a little bit about Trash Butler. Trash Butler, you know, you partnered with, I think Florida Funders organized that, and that was the biggest organized investment they had made to date. So what was your mindset in starting this business and going out and raising capital for it versus bootstrapping?
Yeah, you know, Trash Butler was originally thought it was going to be something that we could sort of do with the College Hunks franchise system. You know, we were looking for a B2B asset light recurring revenue model, which was different than what the College Hunks business is. It's more residential, it's more one-off service. We quickly realized that it really needed to be its own standalone business. The way it works is we sign contracts with apartment communities. We have what we call butlers that go out, you know, 5 nights a week and pick up the trash from the resident's doorstep. It is very tech enabled, you know, so it's almost like, you know, an Uberized workforce where they can log in from the app, they show up, they take pictures, they are given their job assignments, you know, all remote from their mobile phone. We're able to also manage the decentralized workforce, you know, from our headquarters here in Tampa. So we have contracts in 40 states. We knew it was going to take, you know, a lot of capital and money to scale. And having bootstrapped College Hunks and knowing that took 15 years to get where it is today, we didn't want to do that again. So we wanted to go out and tap into the venture world here in Florida. And Florida Funders has emerged as being really, I think, the leader in sort of this hybrid VC PE world. And the thing that's really cool about them is the network effect that you get, because we have 99 investors that came in through Florida Funders. So that's 99 people that are, you know, pushing Trash Butler to their network that are might have some first one degree of separation to multifamily or might be in multifamily themselves. So we've been able to benefit from the large network that Florida Funders provides.
Wonderful. What's the future hold for you?
You know, the future is going to be really focused on scaling both College Hunks and Trash Butler, you know, trying to continue to get to the next level. I think, you know, for us, it's kind of the game of business. You know, I used to play video games as a kid and you're always trying to get to that next level and it gets a little more complex. So for me, it's just, I have fun playing the game of business and it's fun to see, you know, our team members excel in the platforms that we have and just keep taking it to the next level.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing your origin story.
My pleasure.